studying extreme weather from atop Mount Washington. People began making formal weather observations from the top of Mount Washington in 1870. The current weather observatory there has been operating since 1932. There is a lot of data from researchers to learn from, and they continue to learn. At 6,288 feet, Mount Washington is the highest peak in the Northeast. It is known as the place with the most extreme weather in the world, which may or may not be true, but still, 100-mile-an-hour winds are not unusual. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we are broadcasting live from the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center in North Conway. We'll talk with some of the folks who spend days at a time on top of the mountain known as the Rock Pile, all in the interest of better understanding our weather. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Have you heard? There's another nor'easter on the way, and the people here with me will be right in the thick of it. We're lucky to be live in the Mount Washington Valley, in the shadow of one of the world's best-known weather outposts. We're going to learn about the science that takes place at the Mount Washington Observatory and what it's like to witness some of the most extreme weather on Earth. And we will get an update on the latest storm. Join me to share some weather insights and to offer a look at the work that takes place at the top of Mount Washington. Joining me here, Sharon Schilling, who is president of the Mount Washington Observatory. Tom Padham is a meteorologist and educational specialist at the observatory. And Eric Kelsey is director of research here at the Mount Washington Observatory. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever been to the top of Mount Washington? Do you wonder about the work that takes place there? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. And if you happen to be near a computer, I encourage you to visit our website or Facebook page. Our videographer, Maine Public's Brian Bouchard, put together an amazing video. He spent a weekend up with the weather observers, and the 10-minute video gives a really great look at Mount Washington and the people who work there. And if you want to watch this program right now, we're streaming Maine Calling on Facebook Live. Thank you all for being here today. And Sharon, I'm going to start with you. If you are here at the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center, you realize that it used to be a much less high-tech operation, but that it's been here a long time. The original building or a copy of the original building is upstairs?
That's absolutely a copy of the building. The original building no longer exists. If you take many, many years of beating on the summit by the wind and the all the rest of the weather factors, it doesn't last forever. So it decomposed and it had to be taken down. And then the state of New Hampshire built a new visitor center up at the top of the mountain, and we relocated our facilities into the Sherman Adams Visitor Center in 1980.
Okay, so, but there has been a formal weather observatory at the top of Mount Washington since the 1930s.
Well, actually, there's been a weather observation post, if you will, on and off since before that, since the 1800s. Back in the 1800s, the Signal Corps was doing weather observations, but they didn't necessarily do them year-round because of the harsh conditions. They couldn't withstand the conditions up there. So, but in 1932, Joe Dodge and some of his friends and other observers, specifically Bob Monahan and Alex McKenzie, got together and they petitioned the New Hampshire Academy of Sciences for a small grant to, in honor of the 50th polar anniversary, to start weather observations year-round again at the top of Mount Washington. Joe Dodge understood, having grown up in this area and lived in this area and dedicated his life to Mount Washington, and not just to the trails or not just to the top of the mountain, but to really to the entire valley. He understood the importance of what Mount Washington was. He understood more so than virtually anybody, I think that the reason to be at the top of the mountain was to gather those weather statistics, was to observe not just the individual data that we collect, but to understand the collective effect of what weather does to a mountain, to the valley, to the area here, and why that was important to the rest of the country. So he was kind of a visionary.
Eric, what kind of research, I mean, what's measured? I know wind speed is measured famously and temperature. What else is measured? And then you can impress us with some statistics about some of the wind speeds and temperatures you've seen up here.
Yeah, we measure, over 15 different variables. Tom might have an exact number off the top of his head, but everything from cloud height to cloud type to visibility and, you know, if there's an undercast, humidity, temperature, of course, electric field, you know, when there's a thunderstorm rolling through, we have an electric field meter to show you know, if there's going to be a lightning strike soon or if the possibility is there. We measure all sorts of things, and we also have some remote weather stations that are automated. It's part of our Mesonet, as we call it. We have about 20 other Mesonet sites. There's several of them along the Otter Road that you'll see if you ever drive up the Otter Road. There's two on the Cog Railroad side, and then we have others stretching as far away as Cannon Mountain, which is to the west, about 25, 30 miles.
So the information from the Mesonet gives you, and that's a new word for me, by the way, that gives you a more complete look at what's happening at the on the mountain.
That's right, and across the White Mountains as well. So we can see what other weather is going on and what might be rolling in soon. Weather is highly variable up, you know, with elevation. So the weather on top of the mountain, like this morning, was above this marine deck of clouds that was starting to roll in. So it was beautiful on top of the mountain this morning, or so I'm told, and I could see as I was driving into the office this morning. But down low in the valleys, the clouds were rolling in. It was 32 degrees, whereas I started out in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and it was down to 20 this morning. So a lot can vary across a very short distance across the rugged mountains of the Whites here. Mm.
So Tom, being a meteorologist on the top of Mount Washington isn't like another meteorology job, is it? The meteorologists I know spend a lot of time looking at computer screens. What about you?
We do that for a time, you could say, but we have a great variety of tasks that we do over the course of the day. Every single hour, one of our observers is physically stepping outside in those weather conditions. We're producing a forecast for the higher elevations of the White Mountains, giving people a good heads up to those weather conditions. And then also we're maintaining all of that instrumentation in some pretty exciting weather.
So when you, the video that Brian Bouchard shot that I encourage everybody to look at on our Facebook page or on our webpage shows some pretty dramatic conditions. Are you harnessed when you walk out to this equipment?
That's a really common question, and actually we don't use any sort of tether or harness, and the reason for that is the second you get slack in a 100-mile-an-hour rope, it's basically whipping around at 100 miles an hour. It could be pretty dangerous, actually. So the safest thing to do in very high winds is actually get as low to the ground as possible. Luckily for us, there are plenty of pretty sheltered locations as we're going out for those weather observations, but still you might be kind of army crawling your way back to a door if you were knocked over in extremely high winds.
So there's some real dedication going on.
Definitely. And I mean, we're all very enthusiastic about our job and about the weather that we see up there. So for me, there's no place else that I'd rather be.
Okay. What are the records, Eric? What's the impress us?
Sure. Well, I think most people, or at least a lot of people, are most familiar with our record wind speed of 231 miles per hour that occurred on April 12th, 1934, just not even 2 years after we established our observatory at the summit, holed up in the Otter Road stage office. We didn't have our own building at the time. Other records, 72 degrees Fahrenheit is our record warm temperature, high temperature, which has occurred twice.
It has never been warmer than 72 degrees on the top of Mount Washington. Wow.
Not since 1932 anyway. And our record cold temperature, record low, is negative 47 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay. And people, I know that the line is the most extreme weather on Earth. Is it really the most extreme weather on Earth?
To be determined. Let's put it that way, right? As far as we know, it is arguably the most extreme conditions on Earth, especially in the wintertime. You know, in Antarctica, you get very cold temperatures and strong winds, but at least in places where we have weather stations, nothing's really clearly exceeded the extremes that we see here.
Okay. Sharon, how does it all work? I know that there are shifts involved and volunteers, and how do people get up to this place in the winter time and get back down, and what kind of shifts do the meteorologists work?
So a meteorologist shift is a week-long shift, usually Wednesday to Wednesday, but Mother Nature dictates, so we could be doing shift change anytime from a Tuesday to a Friday, or maybe every once in a while not at all. They might have to stay. But it's usually a week-long shift, 24 hours a day for the 7 days that they're there. In the winter, the road is closed to the public, but we have a specific vehicle. It looks very much like a snow grooming vehicle that you would see on a ski resort mountain. Ours has a cab on the back of it that holds up to about 10 or 11 people. And so we bring all of the weekly groceries, all of their baggage, their clothes, everything that they need to run that week-long shift, and then some. Sometimes we're bringing instruments, and sometimes we're bringing other people up with us to go up and participate in a shift change for the day. We have a program, in fact, this winter called Arctic Wednesday, that we bring teachers up with us, and they're able to connect back to their classrooms and understand and teach and impart some information back to their classroom for what they understood going up the mountain. The mountain, I tell people all the time, the mountain is really almost like two mountains. What happens below 5,000 feet and what happens above 5,000 feet. Because it's so sheltered with the tree line and everything else that happens below the 5,000 feet, it's kind of a different world. Once you get on top of the mountain, it's a subarctic region. It looks like the surface of the moon to anybody who has, ever tried to figure out what the top of Mount Washington looks like, especially in the winter because it's snow covered. There are times you can't see anything. And going up the mountain can be quite a precarious situation. It can take us anywhere from about an hour and a half to 8 hours.
Whoa.
Yes. The snow cat, as we call it, only travels max 8 miles per hour. And even then, sometimes we're not crawling along at 8 miles an hour. We're moving pretty slow just to make sure where we are, because you're on the auto road, not a very large road. It's not a two-lane highway. It's a small road up the side of the mountain. So getting up and down is almost an all-hands evolution. We have a team of drivers who are certified to drive the snowcat. We have individuals who help deal with the logistics. The observers themselves do food shopping in order to bring groceries up and down the mountain for fresh vegetables and fruits every week. They have a staple of things that are up there for frozen foods and canned goods, but they do a weekly shopping to bring up what they want for those meals. We have a team of volunteers, usually two volunteers per shift, that go up with us, and a lot of them are very well seasoned volunteers who have been around for a long time and are almost like family. They help with cooking the meals because, as you heard Tom say, the observers are pretty busy. They every hour are off doing an observation, and there's a night observer and a day observer. You can't do it 24 hours a day, so they split the shift. In order to help them with some of the everyday routine things of surviving in a remote mountain site, things like a little bit of cleaning, dishes, and cooking food, cooking meals is done by volunteers who are amazing. We could not do this without our volunteers. I love our volunteers.
Tom, I want to talk to you about the storm that's coming. I mean, we didn't plan this show when we knew that there was a big nor'easter coming, but you are going to be headed back up for your shift tomorrow morning, right?
Yep, and it's looking like we'll be seeing plenty of snow on the summit of Mount Washington, probably between 1 and 2 feet. And it's really actually going to continue on the summit, at least, and across a lot of the White Mountains through at least Friday night, maybe even through Saturday and Sunday, still snow showers continuing there. So
why will it last longer on the top of Mount Washington than in the rest of New England?
Just because of the upslope flow that we get. So we're kind of wringing out the last bits of that moisture with that storm, and it's going to be kind of stalling out over the area. So we'll be adding more to that 1 to 2 foot total, actually, getting into the weekend.
So this is what I want to ask you. When you know that a storm's coming, is this exciting for you, or is it just part of the job?
No, it's exciting. It's definitely exciting. And especially, actually, I'm looking forward to the winds aren't supposed to be too high with this storm. Most of the time, the snow that we get up there just blows right off the summit. But if we get some nice light winds, then we have actually pretty good drifts that build up on the summit, and it's a little bit more fun to play around in that, too.
Okay, so you find some time to actually enjoy the snow that's up there?
I mean, I'll go measure the snowfall by collecting the precip cam, but I can kind of skip my way through some big snowdrifts if I want, or have a little bit of fun.
What's the atmosphere like among the observers? So up there will be three observers, two or three volunteers?
Yep, so three weather observers, one that's working over the course of the night, actually, and then 2 day observers working from about 5 a.m. to 5 p.m., then there's one or two interns and then one or two volunteers also. So really about 6 people total during the wintertime. Definitely can be quiet up there, but we do have guests that are coming up and we're having educational programs, and there's always a lot going on.
So what's the atmosphere during a storm?
Excited. I would say everyone is usually pretty excited. As I said earlier, we're all very enthusiastic about the work that we do. And so having a big storm up there that adds to that excitement.
No, it's not just excitement. It's borderline giddy. The worse the winds get, the more things blow, the worse the weather prediction would be for someone, you know, down here, the happier they get. It is truly actually fun to watch and see them get giddier and giddier and happier the worse the weather gets. So
while the rest of us are just cringing and hoping our power doesn't go out, you all are just cheering away. That's so funny. What do you hope for, Eric? What are you hoping for a record? Are you hoping to learn something new? What is your best case scenario from a big storm like this?
I grew up in New Hampshire, and so what my favorite weather that got me really hooked as a child were nor'easters. So this is perfect. I love it. There can't be enough snow. I don't know what enough snow is. I haven't seen it yet. Bring it on. 2 feet, 3 feet. I just wish I could be on the mountain more to see the extreme winds, but I do have responsibilities that keep me in the valley a lot. I'm always looking for more.
Okay. Well, we do have to go to a break. We'd love to have you ask questions either in our radio audience by calling 1-800-399-3566, emailing us at talk@mainepublic.org, tweeting at Maine Calling, or posting to our Facebook page. Also, our audience here in North Conway at the Weather Discovery Center, you're welcome to come up and ask a question after the break. We'll be right back. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Audubon, a community of people who understand that when Maine's wildlife thrives, Maine thrives. Learn more at maineaudubon.org.
For decades, a chemical plant in Louisiana was releasing toxic pollution, and everyone felt powerless to stop it.
My mother succumbed to bone cancer. My brother had lung cancer. My sister, I think it was cervical cancer.
Then they decided to fight.
One thing I know, if I don't fight, I'm not going to win.
How one town took on a chemical giant. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. And you may listen to All Things Considered on your way home or while cooking dinner, but the news doesn't stop there. Over on Maine Public Television, you can join the PBS News Hour for developments in the day's important stories. You can watch it at 7 each evening on Maine Public Television and at 10 on the Maine Public World Television Channel. The program is known for its thoroughness, fairness, and impartiality. It's commercial-free, as you'd expect from public media. More and more viewers are tuning in each evening to this news source you can trust, the PBS NewsHour, at 7 each evening on Maine Public Television.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're broadcasting from the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center. Joining me, Sharon Schilling, president of the Mount Washington Observatory. Tom Padham is a meteorologist and education specialist. And Eric Kelsey is director of research. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. And you can watch this program on Facebook Live if you would like. Just go to our Facebook page or go to the Mount Washington Observatory Facebook page. And we welcome all of you in the room to ask questions as well. I'm going to go first to a tweet from Travis, or excuse me, an email. And I think this is kind of funny, but I know you guys can answer it. Can you please remind listeners what this show has to do with the state of Maine? I'm confused. As much as I love Jen and Mount Washington, New Hampshire Calling? Why should people in Maine care what goes on at the top of Mount Washington?
Weather. the weather that the top of the mountain experiences helps to us to understand, as we're doing this data collection, as we're doing the observations, that weather goes into a larger database which feeds GRAIMAIN, specifically the National Weather Service there, and helps them with their forecasts for this entire region and actually the entire United States. It's just one of the data sets that they use in order to create that compilation. And the more we understand weather, then obviously the more that we're able to predict future weather patterns, do a better job of forecasting their current weather patterns, those kinds of things. So yes, someone in Maine should be interested, not necessarily concerned, but interested with what happens at the top of Mount Washington.
Sure, and you can see Mount Washington on a clear day from much of southern Maine and even from Portland. And it's so fun to think about, you know, when you glance over on a beautiful clear day and you see the top of Mount Washington, that what might be going on up there is not at all what it seems when you glance up in that sunny day, is it?
No, definitely not. And I would say that we're the pinnacle of New England. And so looking at the greater New England area, we're just this fascinating place with some really interesting weather and really actually some of the worst weather on earth right here in our backyard in New England.
And how does the existence of Mount Washington and the White Mountains affect the weather to its east in southern Maine?
Yeah, that's a great question. I also work jointly. I'm in joint position with Plymouth State University, and there's been graduate students who have looked at some of the weather that's occurred in the lee side or the east side of the White Mountains, and thunderstorms can often form in the lee of the mountains when the wind direction's flowing just right. So we're learning more about how that happens and how the mountains affect thunderstorm development over in Maine. We're also, running computer models that, simulate weather across the whole region. And you can't just, slice the region in half based on political borders, right? It's all contiguous. The earth doesn't care. The atmosphere doesn't care about borders. And so the weather that moves across the state of New Hampshire, the White Mountains, interacts with the topography, the mountains, and becomes different, right, downstream in Maine. So, yeah, there's a big impact.
It matters.
Yeah.
We'll go to Dover, New Hampshire, and Steve. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi there. My parents back in the 60s bought a camp on Lake Winnipesaukee, and we can see the summit of Mount Washington from our camp 70 miles away. And it was always a wonderful thing in the evening when WCSH Channel 6 would come on with a weather report and the report from Mount Washington. And the meteorologist, when we were lucky, would be Marty Angstrom, who had the best down east draw that anybody ever heard. And I'm wondering if anybody there remembers Marty or knows what's up with Marty Angstrom these days.
I've been here for a year and a half as the president of the organization, and I've never knew Marty. I never met him. I don't really have any idea. I can tell you we have a cat named after
him. I was going to say there's another Marty.
Yeah, the Marty the cat at the top of the mountain is named after Marty Angstrom in his honor. So, Marty kind of lives on, and if anybody does know the whereabouts or how to get in touch with Marty, I'd love to talk with him. I'd love to do kind of an interview like this with him because of those days that he spent on top and the days that he would do those very animated meteorological reports, I hear. So
that's great. And Marty the cat, Tom, you go up for a week at a time, but Marty the cat doesn't come back down, right?
No, Marty is the only permanent resident of the summit, actually, and he's been up there for 10 years now. He's sort of the summit mascot, you could say. We have a lot of people that follow us for the weather, but we also have a lot of people that follow us specifically just for updates on the cat.
And I'm guessing he lives a pretty good life.
Yes, definitely. He gets a lot of treats donated to him, actually, since we are a nonprofit organization. A lot of people donate to the cat and make sure that he is well-fed and pampered, you could say, on the summit of a mountain.
Spoiled, almost.
How does it happen that Marty got there? Did someone smuggle him as a kitty? I mean, how did this work? Do we know? Or was he just there one day?
So basically, we got him from the Conway shelter, and it was during the New Hampshire primary, and so there was actually a cat election. There was three candidates.
Oh my gosh.
And this was the 2008 election, I believe it was, and Marty got more votes than the New Hampshire primary candidates.
And the observatory has a history of having cats. Ever since our first winter up here, there have been cats with the observers. In fact, during the world record wind speed back in 1934, I believe there were a total of 7 cats in the stage office to witness that record wind along with the observers.
More cats than people at that point.
Highest wind speed observed by a cat also.
We'll go to Scott calling from Lewiston. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hi. I am AM32 out of Lewiston, a severe weather watcher for the National Weather Service. And I would like to expand my involvement in this program. How do I do it?
That's probably something we would need to talk with the National Weather Service about, the specifics that they have for that particular program and how to expand people's participation in it.
Okay, Scott, thanks for calling. Alyssa on Facebook says, I spent a night on the summit in January 2007 with an EDU trip. Mount Washington Observatory helped fuel my love of weather and helped me decide to pursue a college major in meteorology.
That's great, yeah.
Yeah, is this a story you hear?
Very often.
Yeah, so tell us about the EDU trips. Sharon, what are these and how does one get to take part?
So one of the things that fuels us, if you look at our mission statement, is the fact that we want to educate others about what it is that we do up there. And just like Alyssa, encourage that enthusiasm for weather and the environment and the climate and understand how it impacts your everyday life. And so one of the things that we do is we sponsor these EDU trips. They are overnight trips to the summit of Mount Washington, and they can be either during the summertime or during the wintertime. Obviously, the winter involves a snowcat trip to get there and can be a little bit dicier to do, but much more extreme from a weather standpoint. And when we take someone up the mountain, we're educating them along the way. Going up the road, we're talking to them about the difference, that same subject that I mentioned before about it being almost two different kinds of mountains. The fact that it's the most prominent geological formation from Canada to North Carolina out to South Dakota, that there are three main weather tracks that come right across the top of Mount Washington, and that when they're brought together, that's what makes some of those extreme conditions that you see. And so we use those EDU trips in order to do that, to educate people, give them a little bit about the science and history of the mountain, you know, what was there before we were there, how it's made up from a geological formation, and just try to do our best to educate people about what Mount Washington Observatory is all about, and the fact that it's actually a number of different entities that are on the top of the mountain, Mount Washington Observatory being the nonprofit organization that we are. But we are a resident in the State Parks building. The State Park owns basically the summit cone of the top of the mountain, but there's also the White Mountain National Forest and, you know, a number of other entities that operate in conjunction with the top of the mountain. We're not alone. We just happen to be, I think, the most prominent when you talk about the top of the mountain.
We'll go to Robert, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi,
you're on Main Calling.
Hi. Thanks for a wonderful program, as usual. Listen, I've been intrigued with this 1937 highest recorded wind speed, and I just heard about 3 weather tracks that converge there, which sort of explains a little bit. But I'm just wondering, you know, with all due respect to our beautiful Mount Washington, there probably are a few mountains a little higher in Antarctica and maybe even in Nepal. And I'm wondering why, with all the weather tracks that might exist there, that record still stands. Maybe you could explain that record and what it all means. Thank you.
So, Robert, I don't think we're saying it had the highest wind speed in the world. Oh, it did. Okay, go ahead, explain.
Yeah, at the time, it was the world record wind speed. Since then, in 1996, Barrow Island, an island owned by Australia, just north of the continent, during a tropical cyclone did record, there was a remote weather station that did record a faster wind speed of 253 miles per hour. At the time, meteorologists just kind of looked at that and said, oh, that can't be right, and they just, you know, moved on. It wasn't until 10 years later that someone came across that data point and said, hey, we should investigate this. And so the World Meteorological Organization formed a committee to investigate. The anemometer that actually recorded that wind speed was long gone. It wasn't in use anymore. And so they just You know,
it kind of has an asterisk next to it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. You know, and so we respect the that they have the world record now. And we claim that, well, we had humans there back in 1934 to verify it, make sure that the instrumentation was working. We actually calibrated our instrument both before and after the world record wind speed to make sure that everything was working properly. So I am very confident that our 231 mile per hour recorded wind speed is accurate and legitimate, and we hold our hat on that.
Yeah. But to answer a little bit more of his question, I would suspect that there may be other places in the world that might have higher wind speeds. The problem is there's no way to record that. There are no remote weather stations or wind recording instruments located that I'm aware of at maybe the top of Nepal or somewhere in Switzerland. We are a manned 24-hour weather station, and so it is possible to record the wind speeds here, perhaps not possible other places.
There's very, very few other places that are at a similar elevation to us that see consistently as bad of weather as we see also. One out of every 5 days during the wintertime, we see 100-mile-an-hour winds. So
one out of every 5 days?
Yes.
So what is it like to go out and work on the instrumentation 100-mile-an-hour winds, Tom?
Well, I would say it's fun, but it's also difficult, too. Just being able to stand in the force of an 100-mile-an-hour wind is incredibly difficult. And the second you get a gust higher than that, it's probably going to be knocking you over.
We'll go to Erwin calling from Portland. Hi, Erwin.
Hi, Jennifer. I've always been interested in the weather and always been interested in what is being done on Mount Washington as well. I had a couple of questions. One, do they generate their own electricity up there, or do they have a cable running from down below, probably on the ground? And then the other one was, what do they use to cook their food with and to heat the facility?
So we actually are on grid power. There is a line that runs along the Cog Railway underground, actually. Luckily underground, where it's nice and safe there. And we do have backup generators in the event that we do lose power, though. And we do occasionally, if the valley loses power, maybe during an ice storm or something like that, those generators kick on for us. And then we use kerosene, actually, to heat the building. And we eat very, very well on the summit with the volunteers that we have up there cooking dinner at the end of the day for us. So I'll be doing the food shopping, actually, shortly after this.
So you're sitting here half doing the interview, half thinking about what you want to buy, right?
I'm always thinking about food, yeah.
And, Erwin, I encourage you to look at the video that was shot by Maine Public's Brian Bouchard, because we have some of the volunteers cooking there, and you'll get a sense that they're living pretty high, not just in elevation, but high on the hog when they're eating up at the Mount Washington Observatory. Doug on Facebook wants to know, how often do you observe aurora borealis from the summit?
I know the answer to that. I would say on average it's about once every 3 to 4 months, so it's not all that common, actually. We do have great views. On a clear day, we can see 130 miles, so all the way out to the Adirondacks are the furthest points that we can see. And we can see the Canadian skyline, but we spend two-thirds of the year in the clouds, so then our view is basically zero. So we need to have all of those things come together with a solar storm that's going to produce an aurora, and then also clear conditions for us and no clouds overhead also.
An email from Luna. Can you ask your guests if they have seen or encountered anything strange or supernatural, UFOs, on top of the mountain? Anything you can't explain, really?
I worked nights, actually, for 2.5 years on the summit and never really saw anything too out of the ordinary. There's definitely a lot of ghost stories up on the summit. We have had people living up there since the late 1800s. And once I saw a fireball, actually, in the sky is the only pretty interesting thing. It was basically a meteor that kind of broke apart in the sky there.
We'll go to Felix calling from Milo. Hi, Felix. Go ahead.
I want to make a statement, and please evaluate it, criticize, whatever. Say, because a windy environment contains more energy than an ambient environment, it is actually warmer when the wind blows.
What do you think of Felix's theory?
I think it depends on how warm or how windy it is.
Okay. Yeah. All right, Felix, thanks for calling. We'll go to Tom, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, good show, you guys. I am calling partly to make a connection with Maine for all of you and to tell you that I was a co-worker, so to speak, with Marty Engstrom for 10 years. because I was the weather reporter on Channel 8, WMTW, whose call letters stand for Mount Washington, and our studio was in Maine. When I was there for 10 years, it was in Poland Spring, and then later it moved, and of course the transmitter was on the summit of Mount Washington, which is why Marty Engstrom and those other guys that worked for us were up there, was because they were what we called transmitter engineers. They took care of the equipment, made sure we were on the air when we were supposed to be. And so Marty, according to my latest rumor mill, is alive and well and living in Freiburg. And he's written a book about life on the summit. And as far as I know, he still takes his slideshow around and visits various organizations and talks about his many years on the summit. And I believe, just as a final note, that Channel 8 went on the air in 1950, so it has a long, long history of residency, so to speak, on the summit of Mount Washington.
Tom, thank you so much for calling in. Paul Janis also wrote in with the same note that Marty Engstrom, live and well, living in Freiburg. So thank you so much for calling in. On that note, we do have to take another quick break. We'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
On the next Fresh Air, the Steele dossier on Russian interference in the election and Trump's ties with Russia. We talk with New Yorker staff writer Jane Mayer. She writes about the bizarre twists and turns of how the dossier came to be, what the Clinton campaign knew and didn't know about the dossier, and why so little was done after Steele warned the FBI. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for World Affairs. Today, it's a conversation with Ambassador Dennis Ross, former negotiator for peace processes in the Middle East and leading advisor on the region to Presidents George H.W. Bush, Reagan, Clinton, and Obama. That's on the next World Affairs, coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the work being done atop Mount Washington. We are live at the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center in North Conway. Joining me, three key people here. Sharon Schilling is president of the observatory. Tom Padham is meteorologist and education specialist. Eric Kelsey is director of research at Mount Washington Observatory. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. I'm wondering, Eric, as director of research, do you have people submitting ideas to you? Is it like when the shuttle goes up and scientists all over the world have things they want to put up on the shuttle? Are there experiments that people all over want you to do at the top of Mount Washington?
I get some requests via email a lot about, hey, have you ever looked at this? Have you ever looked at, you know, what the snow quality is like in the wintertime? Because I'm a big skier and I'd love to know when the snow quality is good, not just, you know, the amount. and then we have a lot of companies that we partner with to test their instrumentation. Companies that produce anemometers and other things. Then, of course, we have more of the commercial industry, you know, that have tested their products up here with us, like paint, you know, exterior paint and windows and coffee machines and dialysis machines, you know, things, you know, we're at a very convenient high elevation location. It's very accessible year round. And so if there's anything that a company is unsure will work at elevation, say at the elevation of Denver, Colorado, they'll bring it up here to the summit and we'll help them test it.
I like the idea of paint. So you can keep the observatory well painted if the paint does work well. And
we don't bother.
It's almost like being sandblasted on a daily basis.
Okay. So we have an email from Eric. Do they measure air quality flowing over Mount Washington? Also, looking at the historical records from Mount Washington, is there a clear climate change fingerprint?
Yeah, air quality, first off, the state of New Hampshire measures ozone concentration on the summit. And they do that all year except for the winter time or so. And the Appalachian Mountain Club is an integral part of looking at that data and better understanding what the air quality is like on the summit. And we've had past research collaborations with the University of New Hampshire and other places that have done air quality monitoring at the summit, measuring things like NOx and sulfur dioxide and things like that. And then the second question.
Do you see a climate change fingerprint when you look at the data?
Yeah, that's one of the things that is a big part of my research. The summit of Mount Washington is indeed seeing a long-term warming trend. Interestingly, though, it is a slower warming rate than the lower elevations of the Northeast. And I've even looked at Mount Mansfield in Vermont, their highest point, where they have a weather station. And indeed, they also have a slower warming rate than the lower elevations of the Northeast. So it seems something's going on, which is unusual, actually, if you look at other mountains across the world where most other mountain ranges are seeing a faster warming rate at higher elevations. And our computer models that our climate models that project out several decades also suggest that virtually all mountains should be warming faster at higher elevations. And so I'm investigating why in the Northeast we're seeing the opposite trend.
Interesting. Great email from Sharon. Dick Hale, who lives in Orland, Maine, and is sitting across the room from me now, worked as a weather observer on Mount Washington in 1966 and 1967. He thinks he is the only one who ever walked up and down the mountain for all of his shifts. He worked with Joe Dodge and Guy Goslin, among others. He has also worked in Tuckerman Ravine and helped build Mizpah Spring Hut. At 89, Dick still enjoys winter weather and storms. I tried to talk him into calling you, but he declined. I decided not to.
So the idea of someone walking up and down for all of their shifts as a weather observer, I don't think was ever recorded. I don't know that anyone ever necessarily tracked that specific characteristic of being a weather observer. But I wouldn't doubt it. In those days, getting up to the top of the mountain involved dragging a sled behind you at some points with your, your bags and your groceries and those kinds of things. It wasn't until much later that we have this wonderful modern convenience that we call a snowcat out in our parking lot, if anyone comes by, is one of the original tracked vehicles, if you will, that we took up and down the mountain. I don't know that I would even necessarily get in it today, but it's out there for people to look at. But before that, it was walking.
Wow.
You had to walk up and down.
Wow. An email from Jack. How do you determine visibility with accuracy?
So we actually basically know the distance of a lot of different points. So we know the distance of the end of the deck if we're in the clouds and how far away that is. We do often report visibility as zero if it's less than 1/16th of a mile, but then I also mentioned on the clearest of days we can see Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks, and that's 131 miles away. So 130 miles is our maximum reportable visibility from our summit weather station.
We'll go to Charlie calling from Portland. Hi, Charlie, go ahead.
Hi, I am a skier, and specifically a skier at Sugarloaf. And Sugarloaf is really windy. And my question is this: you obviously know why it's so windy at Mount Washington. Any suggestions or insights into why Sugarloaf is so windy? Is it the elevation or something else?
Yes, it's definitely the elevation and also just the location here. Northern New England is actually a pretty stormy part of the world. And then being at a higher elevation there, you would expect to see windier conditions. On average, every 3 days or so, we see some sort of storm system coming through, which is keeping our average wind speed up. And we'll be seeing another one here in just 24 hours or so.
He says with a big smile on his face. We have an email from Mark. I grew up behind the weather observatory. The rectory was just torn down. My dad was the minister at Christ Church next door, and watching the weather reports by Marty gave me a deep interest in our daily weather. Do any of you remember the rectory? Yeah, Eric, you're nodding.
I think so, yeah. I think it's the one that was just torn down a year or so ago. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. We'll go to Sylvia calling from Weston. Hi, Sylvia, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I would like to have the person that said he saw a burning meteorite in the sky one night, if I've got the term right. Could he remember what direction it was coming in? And that's my only question. Thank you.
This was about 3 years ago now, I would say, but it was probably like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was facing west, actually, because I was looking back towards our tower, and it scared the bejesus out of me, and all of a sudden basically saw this little fireball, but then it lasted just a second or so, and then it was gone.
All right, Sylvia, thanks for your question. We'll go to Peter calling from the Portland area. Hi, Peter, go ahead.
Well, good afternoon. Yes, as an old fireman and rescue hand, I kind of wondered what you did for emergency situations up there. If you had a fire or something, do you have a place you could retreat to and survive in the weather? Or if somebody has appendicitis or chest pain, something like that?
Good question. Yeah, that's a good question, Sharon.
So all of our observers and Summit staff are trained in wilderness first aid in order to be able to take care of themselves immediately in case there is an emergency. State Park has personnel that stay on the mountain all winter as well. They have a reduced staff. It's only one or two at a time as opposed to the 7 or 8 that might be there during the summer months. But we have them as a resource. The building obviously has fire alarms. The fire marshal does come and do inspections every year to make sure that we're up to code. So there are, you know, a number of fire suppression and fire safety issues. We have emergency exits. And actually, as a matter of fact, one of those things that we're reviewing this year is what to do in case of an emergency. It's always, my background, having been in the Coast Guard, is an operational readiness kind of thing. And so I'm always looking at what are the best safety parameters that we can install. Recently, for the night observer, we installed a safety alarm that should that night observer for some reason not come back inside the building after they take their observation, then there's an alarm that goes off that will alert the other observers who are asleep in the bunk rooms a floor below them that he or she hasn't come back inside the building. So safety is a big issue for us. We want to make sure, obviously, that everything stays exactly as it is, nice and safe and warm and cozy, and that people are able to be there and be there safely. So,
Peter, thanks for the question. We're going to go to Robert, who's calling from Milford. Hi, Robert. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Oh, good afternoon. I'm curious as to what kind of animal life you see up there on the top of the mountain, from, you know, worms, invertebrates, insects, mammals, birds. You probably don't see many fish.
I've never seen a fish on the summit, no. I have seen actually a frog, though, so one amphibian, but frequently it's birds, really. Ravens are the most common animal that we see on the summit, and besides that, there's not too much in the way of food, actually, for most larger animals, so really birds are the most common thing.
Okay.
And occasionally you'll see a moose on the auto road. I've seen that on a couple of occasions. And to bring Marty Engstrom back into the discussion, you can find online this great video of him talking about a time that there was a moose on the observation deck.
Okay. We have a question here in the audience. Go ahead. What's your name?
My name is Vanessa, and I'm wondering, the stars are probably beautiful up there, and I'm wondering if an astronomer has ever requested a telescope to be added to the observatory.
I know that we have had requests for that, but unfortunately, since we spend so much time in the clouds, that really limits the chances for us to have great views. But when we do have a nice clear night, we do actually have some really great viewing of the stars. Our night observer on my shift, Ryan Knapp, has been on the summit for 12 years now and takes some really great night photography also.
The other issue with astronomy instruments would be that we don't heat those. Those wouldn't be heated. So in the winter, they would get covered with a foot thick rime ice on them and not be usable. So and plus the high winds might blow them off or crack them. So
I want to ask about a couple things before we go. And the first is the importance of checking summit forecasts. I understand there are a lot of people who use not just Mount Washington, but, go up in the winter time that maybe don't take the precautions they ought to. What's available to them? What can you do before you go up into the White Mountains on a weekend, for example?
Well, I would say check the forecast. So twice daily, we're updating that forecast at about 4 a.m. and 4 p.m.
On your website?
Yep, mountwashington.org. Yep. And those weather conditions can be drastically different from the lower elevations. And so it's really crucial that you're prepared for those weather conditions coming up to the summit or any of the higher elevations in the White Mountains here.
Okay. And you also do some Facebook Live, right? If you want to a Friday night, you're thinking of going to the White Mountains over the weekend, you can get a live update, right?
Yeah, and get into the details. So we'll go through actually how we're producing that forecast and also what we're looking at with the models, maybe how those models are changing over time also. So we'll be talking about the upcoming storm this weekend too.
So Sharon, if somebody has been listening to this program and thinks, I want to volunteer on the top of Mount Washington, I want to come live there for a week and cook for the observers, how does one get involved?
So Mount Washington Observatory is a nonprofit, private nonprofit organization. In order to volunteer, you have to be a member. We have memberships at various levels, everything from an individual student all the way up to family and then club level membership. And so I highly encourage people to become a member and support the observatory. As you can well imagine, it's not a cheap endeavor to manage an observatory in a remote mountain site 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have a government contract with the National Weather Service to provide them that data. But the rest of what we do is really sponsored and paid for by grants and membership dollars, donations, corporate sponsorships, those kinds of things. If you're an individual who thinks that Mount Washington Observatory would be a really, really great, you know, a great place for you to work and to volunteer, then become a member. Get to know the observatory, understand what it is that we do. We allow individuals to volunteer at the top of the mountain in the summer first. That way they can get an idea for what it's like. Because even in the summer, when the state park closes and everybody goes home and you're up there on the top of the mountain, pretty much all by yourselves, and it gets quiet, it can be a little daunting for some folks. The altitude, even though it's only 6,000 feet, there is 20% only, right? Well, there are much larger mountains, as other people have indicated. It is kind of a training ground for people who want to climb McKinley and some of the other Everests, those kinds of elevations, because there is 20% less oxygen at the top of the mountain. And so that does affect. We do cook using the high altitude directions for cakes and things like that. But become a member, learn what we do, and then ask to be a volunteer during the summer months. And then once that's done and you get sort of rated, if you will, and get the okay, then we make sure that you can find a week to come up in the winter. We do have a little bit of a medical, making sure that you can, what we call self-evacuate, because as the previous caller indicated, what do we do if there's an emergency? When all else fails, you have to be able to walk off the mountain. And so it is a 7.9 mile trek down the mountain, even if you just take the road. So being in the type of health that you would be able to walk down is required.
Well, thank you so much. Jody on Facebook just asked the same question. She wants to be a volunteer, so maybe you'll hear from Jody. Thank you all for being here, and thank you to the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center for hosting. The voice you just heard, Sharon Schilling, president of the Mount Washington Observatory. Tom Padham is also here. He's a meteorologist and education specialist at the Mount Washington Observatory, and Eric Kelsey is director of research at the Mount Washington Observatory. Don't forget to check out the amazing video by Maine Public's Brian Bouchard. It offers an inside look at the Mount Washington Observatory and the people who spend time there. That's on our Facebook page and on our webpage. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. We had additional help from John Bradford and from Nick Godfrey. And a special thank you to everyone here at the Mount Washington Weather Discovery Center, including Keith Garrett and Chrissy Frazier. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to look at the 10th anniversary of Maine's Restaurant Week. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.